When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 52 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's Awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and on this episode, I am thrilled to be joined by a very special guest. Few people in the history of television have ever created and or produced as many hit shows as Chuck Lorre, who has single-handedly kept alive the multi-camera, live-audience comedy format that I Love Lucy popularized in the 1950s, but that has largely faded from the scene in the age of cable and streaming. At the moment, he's the man in charge of the highest-rated comedy on television, The Big Bang Theory, one of the most critically acclaimed comedies on broadcast, Mom, and the just-finishing Mike and Molly, which helped to put Melissa McCarthy on the path to stardom. All three shows air on CBS, for which he also previously made Two and a Half Men, in both its Charlie Sheen and Ashton Kutcher incarnations. Over the course of our conversation, we talk about his circuitous journey to the world of television, the pleasures and bumps he experienced during his rise to prominence on shows like Roseanne, Franny's Turn, Grace Under Fire, Sybil, and Dharma and Greg, why he regrets leaving Dharma and Greg, even though staying would have precluded his remarkable run at CBS, the unique experience of working with and then having to replace Sheen, his thoughts about the future of both The Big Bang Theory, which recently aired its 200th episode, and the multi-camera format in general, the personal meaning to him of the critical love that Mom has received, the likes of which a Lorre show has never seen before, and much, much more. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Chuck, thank you very much for doing this. Really appreciate it. And to begin with, I just always like to ask, for the record, where were you born and raised, and what did your parents do for a living?
Born in Brooklyn, raised on Long Island. My dad owned a luncheonette, which is an archaic thing. I guess it doesn't exist anymore. It was, about 7 or 8 counter stools, short order food, coffee, milkshakes, ice cream, sodas. I was a soda jerk for many years. Mm-hmm. Newspapers, comic books, cigars and cigarettes, greeting cards.
Right. What sort of TV did you consume as a kid? And was there anything that was a particularly formative TV experience for you?
Well, early memories, thanks to my dad, were watching The Honeymooners, Phil Silvers. He was devoted to the Ed Sullivan Show, which I used to argue with him relentlessly about it because it was on at the same time as The Wonderful World of Disney. But we would watch Ed Sullivan, and so what I got was an introduction to every great stand-up comedian there was at the time. Mm-hmm. And that was impactful as well, not recognizing it at the time, but you're watching the best stand-ups in the world.
Did I read something about one particular episode of Ed Sullivan that really stands out?
Oh, Henny Youngman. I wrote about that. I was probably maybe 7 or 8 years old. And Henny Youngman did a joke that my dad probably heard when he was 7 or 8, but it was new to me.
Right.
And the joke was he lifts his arm and he swings it and he says, "Doc, it hurts when I do this." And the doctor says, "Don't do that." That was the joke. And I fell off the couch. I was on the floor. I was clutching my stomach. I was crying. I was laughing so hard. And that got my dad laughing because he couldn't believe that this joke could possibly work on another human being. It was so dusty.
Right. It's right? Like Borscht Belt.
And he started laughing. And then And then it became convulsive. We couldn't stop. And for years after that, if he wanted to make me laugh, he'd just do this with his arm. He'd swing his arm and say, "Don't do that." And I'd go.
Right.
I'd just go. I would have an avalanche of laughter because the structure of that thing I thought was astonishing.
Right.
The simplicity of it.
So now you eventually go off to college, and as I understand it, drop out to pursue for the next 17 years, primarily music, wherever you'll be welcome.
Yeah, and I tried to find my way into songwriting as a career with very limited success.
But we must note for listeners, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles theme song is a big one.
That was a part of my legacy, yeah.
And also Debbie Harry, Non-Blondie biggest hit, right?
I don't know how that factors into her Non-Blondie years, but I was so thrilled and proud right. when I found out that not only did she record the song, but it was a single from that album. Yeah.
So how do you look back on those years? I mean, it seems like that is a very different place than where you've ended up. Was that your real dream to be a musician?
Yeah, my dream. I couldn't imagine doing anything else. I couldn't imagine living a different kind of life. It was hard to put it down. It really was hard to put it down. I was so wrapped up in it. But I had two young children, and I wasn't able to put enough protein on the table. It was really hard to take care of everybody. So TV, first with the Saturday morning animation stuff, seemed like an opportunity to actually pay for dentists and things like that. And
how did that even emerge as an option, though, for somebody that hadn't worked in the business up to that point? I guess aside from the music.
In the 70s, I was writing music, and I hooked up with a guy named Spike Jonze Jr., who Spike's still around doing stuff for the Emmys and TV Academy. And Spike at the time was touring, doing a show based on his dad's act, Spike, the immortal Spike Jonze. And I got into that band, and I was playing guitar with Spike for a couple of years. And then I don't know how it happened, but we wrote our own show of new material and did a couple of songs of his dad's, like Saber Dance and Cocktails for Two, some of the greats. But we're essentially writing sketch comedy to music. And I was always fascinated with music with a comedic bent. I know I was enamored with Randy Newman. I wanted to be Randy Newman with a Stratocaster. That was my dream. Didn't quite play out, but
right.
Comedy was always part of rock and roll for me. I love the Tubes and Danny Elfman's band back in the day, the Oingo Boingo, the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo. There was just some really cool stuff going on. So I was getting my feet wet, not making any money, dying, really, but I was getting a sense of that, you can make an audience laugh, and here's how you do it. And you can actually attach it to music. I think the greatest lesson of that entire experience, as difficult as it was for a long time, just paying the rent was an exciting journey, was none of it was wasted. I wrote hundreds of songs that were probably just landfill, and they're awful, just awful. But the act of doing them and trying to write a coherent piece of music with a lyric that made sense and mattered, it was about something that was 3.5-4 minutes long, was a discipline. And I decided if I'm going to be a songwriter, then I need, whether I'm selling these songs or not, I need to do them. I need to create them. So I was, I would set myself a goal of
right.
at least writing a song one a week, no matter what. There was no excuse. I had to clock in and write. Otherwise, it was a fancy. It was a passing fancy. It wasn't really a discipline.
Right.
And not much came of it, but the discipline mattered.
And so you're doing the children's animation, and then the next big shift, I guess, is how do you make the leap from children's animation to scripted comedy as a live-action series?
Well, even the children's animations, they were film scripts. And in a way, they were cumbersome and more difficult in some ways because you actually had to write out every camera angle. If you wanted an extreme close-up, you had to tell the storyboard artist, "I want an extreme close-up on the magic ring that
right.
that the character is making a wish on." And if you wanted the camera to swoop into that ring and see through the prisms of the ring the face of the character looking at it, you had to write that out so the storyboard artist would execute it in storyboard form, and then it would go to Korea or or Mongolia
right,
for animation.
Right, right.
So it was another discipline to learn how to visualize a scene. And yes, it was a scene that eventually was very limited animation and maybe somewhat crudely done, but the discipline of writing was still similar, the same thing. You had to, if you can imagine it, it could be done in animation, right. But you had to first articulate it on the page.
So I've read stories where, I guess, just independently seeing what you could do with it, you write a Golden Girls script and try to get it to Betty White. You do different...
Oh, that was great. Actually, here's a great show business story. I knew a guy who lived next door to her.
Okay.
And, you know, it helped that I loved that show. I was an enormous fan of that show. Mm-hmm. I thought it was brilliant. It still is. Mm-hmm. It holds up. It was just great writing. Susan Harris. Incredible cast. So... I know the guy lives next door, so I therefore have access, right? I mean, as dumb as that sounds, right. That was my thinking. I'll give it to him, he'll give it to her, I'll have a TV career, right? Very simple. Right. And of course, you know, he said, well, I need to read it first.
What did he do?
He actually was, God bless him, he liked it. He thought it was a good script.
He was a writer?
He was an animation writer.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, very successful
animation
writer.
He was a plumber and he wanted to read it first.
No, he was an animation writer, and God bless him, he put it in your mailbox with a note or something. And I got a handwritten note back from Betty White a couple weeks later. And I'm no fool. I wrote the script and it featured her character. It was actually... I still remember the story. It was really meaningful to me. And she wrote me a note saying she loved the script and she was going to bring it to the producers. And I thought, well, that's it. Here we go. This is the beginning of a career. Right. I'm no longer going to be working bar mitzvahs in Tarzana. I'm in television now.
Right.
And, you know, about a month or so later, the script came back to me with a form letter saying it was not up to their standards. Thank you for your submission.
Oh, my gosh.
And I just, knowing what I know now, I have to imagine the look of horror on the faces of the producers when, Betty White walks in and says, we should do this. Hands a script to them, puts it on the table and says, we should do this. I really like this. I imagine they were very polite and very courteous. And then they went, threw it right in the garbage. But all right, it was, you know what, in a way it was encouraging. The fact that she responded
was
extremely encouraging to me, that I wasn't that far off the mark. Right. It didn't get made. The script got me other work on other shows, and it opened up other doors, not Golden Girls, unfortunately, but it did do its job. It got me work elsewhere, and I started writing.
So it seems that the first big one that came together was Roseanne.
Yeah.
And there were 2 years there when I guess this was the first time you're seeing human beings, visually seeing them delivering your dialogue.
No, it wasn't the first time, but it was the first time I saw major stars, you know. I mean, at the time, you got to remember, Roseanne was the biggest star in the country, if not the world. Mm-hmm. Routinely, the show would get 40 million people watching the show. And they were household names, John Goodman, Laurie Metcalf, Roseanne. It was an astoundingly powerful thing to be part of. And I've discussed this elsewhere, that that first rehearsal where they were running through the scene that I'd been part of, I turned to Bob Meyer, who was the executive producer and a friend of mine. I whispered to him, they're saying what we wrote. I was kind of amazed.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, they're actually saying what we wrote. It was staggering. I was in awe of these people.
Sure. So now, is the reason that you left after 2 years because you had an opportunity to go and create your own show? That's the reason?
Marcy Carsey and Tom Werner came to me with an idea for a show. The star, they had a woman they wanted to play the lead, and they had an idea for what it should be, and they said, we want you to write it. And I was delighted. Franny's turn. I wanted it to be a show about a woman in an unhappy marriage who leaves and goes off to live with her daughter, her grown daughter, and makes a new life for herself. But they were very enamored with the domestic comedy at the time. You have to remember, they were riding an enormous wave of success from Cosby and Roseanne. Mm-hmm. They weren't about to do a show about divorce.
Right.
So that was not in the cards. So I did as I was told. I wrote the pilot script. And it got on the air. It got the coveted 8 o'clock Saturday night spot on CBS. And they really, big commitment. They committed to 6 episodes, which is what they committed to, you know, was Marcy and Tom.
Right.
Whose track record was just outstanding.
Right.
And I was just happy to, you know, ride along.
Right.
Clutching their coattails.
So, you know, that one, unfortunately, after a few weeks, I think that was over. But then relatively soon after, you have Grace Under Fire, get another one off the ground, and then Sybil. And so what I find interesting about those three in a row is that, first of all, three about female protagonists. That was interesting, that because you've obviously done very different things since then. But three in a row there. And then also in each of those cases, for one reason or another, relatively short-lived experiences with those shows. And I wonder for you, does it get disheartening when you pour your life and, you know, heart and soul into these things? And for one reason or another, either in the case of Franny's Turn, you know, I guess it just didn't click.
Didn't work.
Or, you know, with Sybil, it seems like it may not have been your call to exit. Whatever the case may be, is that tough to rebound from when that happens?
It does require substantial amounts of Jack Daniels. It was an easier call. You know, the experience on Grace Under Fire was really volatile. It was a really tumultuous relationship with Brett Butler. And not taking anything away from her, she's a really talented lady, but it was a very unhappy situation. So I asked to leave the show after 13 episodes, which, you know, how unhappy was it? It was the number two show in the country. You know, it was on after Home Improvement or something at the time, and it was enormously successful just because of where it was. And I like to think we were doing a nice job. You know, it was, you know, with Dave Thomas.
I think you guys won the Golden Globe. I mean,
yes.
You did, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. But it was really, really difficult to be there. And they said, please just finish the season, and then we'll figure something out. Mm-hmm. And I think about a month after the holidays or so, the huge 93 earthquake crashed into Los Angeles. And, you know, the roof of the stage caved in, and I was like, come on, let's fix this roof. We got to finish this show. I mean, just, you know, the city is devastated, and I'm just going, come on, put the roof back on. Let's get this done. I want to go home.
Right.
And then after that was over, I somehow wound up developing a show for Sybil Shepherd. And because I'm a slow learner. But, you know, I got to work with Baranski.
Yeah, it was the beginning
of
that, right?
Who's on Big Bang tonight. You know, she plays Johnny Galecki's mother on The Big Bang Theory. And we've been friends for, I don't know, this whole time. So we're talking about 25 years.
And that was her first Emmy,
She won an Emmy out of the gate, first 13 episodes.
That's great.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience to watch that, watch someone with those kind of skills work.
So from these briefer experiences, now you start off Dharma and Greg, and you're on for like six years.
I think it ran 5-6 years, something like that.
And so I guess I wonder where the idea from that came from, and also what the greatest challenges of that may be. I got the sense from reading about it that in this case, and I guess there's always going to be something, but in this case, it's like the network wanted something like promotable storylines. Is that correct?
We're under a lot of pressure in the last couple of years of that series to do highly promotable stories, which, you know, in retrospect was a lesson I've learned the hard way. You know, that's not something you should be doing. You should be telling the appropriate stories that are appropriate to these characters and these relationships, as opposed to what's promotable.
Yeah, what does that even mean?
It means high concept stories, you know, and trying to do that means you're always trying to top yourself too. And this medium for camera, live audience kind of show excels in small stories, internal stories, you know, heartbreak over a relationship ending, the problems that don't involve a lot of pyrotechnics. And that's where this kind of medium really excels. And I knew that. I learned it on Roseanne. That was a very small show. We did small stories about raising a family with all kinds of obstacles, financial obstacles, emotional obstacles, you know, just the normal stories of life is what made that show great. And I learned the lesson. I adapted it in Grace, and I started moving away from it in Sybil, and I allowed myself to completely lose my mind on Dharma. But that being said, you know, Dharma was a lot of fun. The whole premise of that was, is there a show where the female lead was a life-affirming, loving, generous creature of light? Because I had been doing shows where there was a great deal of anger and sarcasm,
right.
And just all kinds of friction in the characters, and they worked. They were
so
great.
It was a conscious decision.
It was a conscious decision. What happens if the female lead is a gloriously joyful character. Would it even be funny?
Right.
And it was a perfect match for Janet Elfman.
Yeah.
Perfect match. She was a dream come true. And what it turned out to be was that, you know, in a way, when you write a character like that, she's almost like an alien.
Yeah.
She's almost, you know, like a visiting from another planet because she was the character who walks down the street with her husband and feeds other people's parking meters rather than a stranger get a ticket.
Right.
Because it's just the right thing to
right.
do, you know. And that was a great lesson that you could take a character and find comedy out of a positive
mm-hmm. and that was
perspective.
Definitely been applied since in others of yours, which we'll come to. But
sure.
It seems that it was a major turning point in your life when you had to decide whether or not to leave Dharma and Greg and go with Warner Brothers to other pastures. What was your thought process at that time? It seems like
I was very stupid.
You think so?
Yeah, I really was. It was one of the bigger mistakes of my career, leaving Dharma after 4 years. And
why do you feel that way?
Because I, you know, it's a child that you've birthed and you need to care for it. And you need to care for it right through till they turn out the lights. And leaving that show prematurely was a mistake. I got dazzled coming the opportunity to come here to Warner Brothers. I still was a consultant, but when you're not there, when you're not hands-on, you know, boots on the ground kind of deal, it's not your show anymore.
But if you had not left, a lot of these other shows might not have happened.
I'm not saying that wonderful things came about as a result of coming to Warner Brothers, but I regret leaving Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. If I could do it again, I would have made a different choice.
Wow.
Regardless of the outcome, it plays into Big Bang right now. We're finishing our 9th season, and we're at 10, 15 episodes. And I don't know how long it's going to go, but I would hate to step away and miss any moment of it. Because
mm-hmm.
these things don't roll around too often. You don't want to miss it. And,
yeah.
and you want to protect the body of work so that whenever someone turns on the TV and sees an episode, any episode, it's worth watching.
Mm-hmm. Well, one side legacy of Dharma and Greg is that beginning with the first episode, I believe you began your vanity cards, which are very interesting. For people who may not know what we're referring to when we say vanity cards, can you explain what that is and how that began for you?
When you create a show and you executive produce the show, traditionally, and long before I came along, they give you a card that flashes on the screen for 2 seconds that you can put your name on. Gary David Goldberg had Sit Ubu Sit, right? Which was wonderful, and Stephen Canal had him tearing out a paper from a typewriter, and it animates, and it flies away, and Stephen Bochco's father, man was playing the violin, which I think was supposed to evoke Stephen's father, and so they give you this. I always assume they don't give anything. It's in lieu of cash.
Right.
I assume they're giving you this card, and it doesn't signify. It became known as a vanity card because it really doesn't signify that you're producing the show. You're not deficit financing it. It's not your studio. It's not your stage. They're not your cameras. You're not handling the payroll. You know, well, Bochco did. Yes, he was a real deal. He was a real company. So it's a vanity card in the sense that it's when it says your card, and then the real card is Warner Brothers, Universal, Sony, Fox. That's not a vanity card. It's their show.
Yeah, right.
They own the darn thing. They own the film. They get to distribute it. They get to skim.
But you chose to
Yeah, and the opportunity came along just before Dharma and Greg debuted. What was that, around 96 or something, 97? And what do you want your vanity card to be? And they were VHS recorders back then, so the only way you could possibly have read these things was if you had a very, very good VHS player that didn't wobble.
Right.
Because if the heads wobbled, then the words were blurring. It just looked like meaningless boilerplate. And for a long time, that's all people thought it was just legal boilerplate.
Right. But you were slipping in some...
I was slipping in stuff, yeah. And, you know, I remember at the time ABC was like, we're not really sure we like this, but we're really not sure we can stop it
right.
because we're really not sure what you're doing.
Right.
And it became a thing I came to like doing because it had no financial value whatsoever. It was never meant to be anything other than just a way to say what's on my mind or what little, what nothing is on my
right.
mind. it's gotten me in trouble in the world of DVRs where it's very easy to pause and read them.
Right.
You know, there came a point where, even now, every one of them is vetted by lawyers now.
And some haven't made it on the air, but they are on your website.
They're on the website, and every time I write censored, it crashes the website. You know what I mean? So
that's funny.
But I've calmed down. I really don't want to use them anymore to create any upset.
Sure.
That's not the point. The point is, like liner notes on record albums, you're too young. But they used to write really cool stuff in the albums about the making of the record and the band. And while you're listening to the record, you'd read. And you were getting a little added value addition to the music. So maybe the vanity card is just, you know, a dollop of extra value to you having watched the show.
People certainly get a kick out of it. But, okay, so you now move into the era here at Warner Brothers, beginning with Two and a Half Men. And a question that I have is when along the line you first realized that you had a hit with this one, because the extent to which that was a hit throughout its whole run is pretty rare.
I started feeling very secure about the thing working when we put the cast together that early. You know, Charlie and John and Angus were just wonderful. I mean, this 8-year-old boy who had this magical quality, saw him in The Rookie. Remember that great movie?
Dennis Quaid?
And he was extraordinary in that film, and he was such an honest actor. You know, he was just, there was no stage kid there.
Right.
He was just a remarkable young man. And John is a comic genius. And Charlie does what Charlie does better than anybody in the world. You know, he's a kind of a Dean Martin character who, no matter how deplorable his behavior, you still liked him.
Right.
And the chemistry between the three just worked. Even when they first started reading together in auditions, it began with Charlie, and then John read with him, and we brought in Angus, and they all read together, and it was like, this is a remarkable dynamic between these three characters. And the pilot worked. Shot it with Jimmy Burrows, and there's always a moment when you're shooting with Jimmy, and you can tell Jimmy knows. Jimmy, you know, you can watch Jimmy's face. He knows when these things are working.
Right.
It happened again when we did the Big Bang pilot. Mm-hmm. We shot that pilot twice, totally rewrote it throughout the first script, wrote an entirely new script, shot it again, added the characters of Wolowitz and Cuthbert Polly. And there's a moment in time when you look across the stage during the evening, and, you know, it's a look that you get from Jimmy going, this thing's working.
Right.
There's something happening here that transcends the words. It's bigger than what you wrote. And you can feel it. Something happens with the chemistry between the actors. Mm-hmm. I really think they make a connection that you can write that two people make a connection. But whether they actually can or not on camera is an entirely different thing. And that happens.
You don't know till you're there.
You don't know till you're there. Yeah.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
One thing which I'm certainly not going to harp on, but I'm curious because it's a rare thing for somebody to have to do, is this transition of a major character comes out of a show, another major actor comes in the middle of a run that then continues pretty tremendously thereafter.
Yeah.
So when that happened with Charlie and then Ashton, did you have any doubt that the show would be able to stay the course?
Sure, I had doubts.
Did you?
Of course. You know, it was a terrible time. It was heartbreaking. I actually thought the show was over.
You did?
I really did. I really thought, you know, this incredible thing that we were having a wonderful time for 8.5 years. At the time, I thought, this is done. I don't see how we can go forward. I remember somewhere in that spring of that year, I'm sorry, my mind is too muddled to actually remember dates, mm-hmm. but I don't know, it just, I remember having this weird kind of thought, well, why not try? I mean, if we fail, no one gets hurt.
Right, nothing's you know, lost.
Nothing's
right?
lost, but why not try? This is great family of people, you know.
And when you say family, you're referring to
the whole production crew, yeah.
Which is how many, like hundreds of people.
Yeah. And why not try? We won't know unless we try. And you know, if we fail and we are ridiculed for having tried and failed, well, we'll deal with the ridicule. Mm-hmm. So what? Mm-hmm. But at least we gave it a shot. And we did 4 more years.
That's amazing.
We did 4 more years and had a blast with Ashton. And we poured our heart and soul into making that transition, that first episode where, you know, he appears in a cloud of Charlie dust, you know, having tried to drown himself right. in the ocean over a bad relationship.
Right.
It was a great lesson in perseverance.
Yeah, yeah.
It kept that family together for another, 80-some-odd episodes.
And have things reached the point enough in the past now that are you able to sort of forgive and move on about that?
Oh, yeah, it's long gone. That's ancient history.
Yeah. So another very rare thing that happened there, starting several years into the run of Two and a Half Men, is you simultaneously bit off Big Bang Theory, as we're saying, and to have 2 shows, even if they stunk, would be a lot to be dealing with, but to have 2 that were very well received, doing very well, I just wonder, before taking on the second one, did you seek advice from anyone, find out how are you even going to physically juggle this?
I actually blind called Norman Lear.
You didn't know each other?
No, and I just said, you know, I looked back at the history of television, who might be able to give me some advice and guidance? Because running 1 show is just ridiculously
right.
hard. I was mostly just running around like a crazy person doing 1 show. How
sure.
could I possibly produce 2? And he was really sweet. He invited me over to his office and sat down with me. And when I explained why I was there and how I was hoping he could give me any hints as to prioritizing, how do you, you know, manage... He had 7 at one point.
Oh, my God.
Okay, he had 7, right? And I remember he said, oh, you're not going to like the answer. And basically, his answer was, you go where the fire is burning the brightest, and you try and put it out.
Put it out, right.
And I asked about delegating. He didn't have much advice about delegating.
No.
You run around from show to show, and you do the best you can.
And how have you, in the subsequent years, when you've been dealing with 2, sometimes 3,
at 4 at one
sometimes
point.
4.
Yeah.
From everything I've read and heard, it's not like you'll ever miss even a read-through or something, of very rarely. So if you're that hands-on, how do you manage your schedule to be that way and also not burn yourself out?
Well, first, I have no life. I have no life, and I'm just perpetually tired.
Right.
But one of the things I love about how this all played out is that these shows are all extremely different from one another. So when you go from 2 and a Half Men to The Big Bang Theory or Mike and Molly or Mom, you're dealing in everything. It's a different tone. There's a different rhythm. The shows are not spinoffs. They're very distinctive things. The exhausting part is shifting gears. But once you shift gears, you're in a whole other environment. You're putting yourself in a place where you're trying to see the world through the eyes of these characters.
Mm-hmm.
What are they feeling? What are they seeing? How might they respond given what's going on in the story? And it's entirely different. There is no crossover from show to show in the way they deal with it. And that's invigorating. But, you know, that being said, there's no way you do this without surrounding yourself with great comedy writers and then leaning on them.
Do you have anybody who, with you, moves from show to show? Any fellow writers or colleagues?
You know, early on in the beginning of Big Bang, I had a couple of guys from 2 and a Half Men crossing over to help. Lee Aronson, Eddie Gorodetsky, Don Foster, Mark Roberts, they all came over and helped. I said, guys, help. Mm-hmm. We're dying here. We don't know what we're doing. And so I had this great veteran writing staff on 2 and a Half Men who, you know, lent of their time and skill to help us. And that's happened pretty much on every one of these mm-hmm. shows. You find ways to reach out. I've watched people over the years try and do a one-man show kind of deal where they're trying to do everything. And it seems like a recipe for failure.
Or meltdown.
Yeah. Or a show that goes 2-3 years and then explodes. Because
mm-hmm.
22, 24 episodes a year in, 8-9 months maybe, is a ridiculous thing to do. And the people that succeeded the most that I learned from coming up when I was a staff writer,
mm-hmm.
they collaborated. They really listened to other people's ideas and opinions. And they didn't necessarily take them,
right.
but their ears were open. And I admired that. And I thought, that's, if I'm going to do this, then the way to do this is to have a great writing staff on each show and listen. Because if it's up to me, I'm alone, I'm going to fail. I'm not going to pull it off.
So considering that you're juggling so many of these at any given time, how far ahead on a storyline can you get? Like, and the reason I ask is, just for instance, with Big Bang, how early on did you know that these characters, like, well, let's take Sheldon, begins a certain way, that he would ever end up as a sexual being, or that Penny and Leonard would ever get married, or mm-hmm. things that
you don't. I didn't. Here's what I knew. I knew that if we brought relationships into the show, if we added Amy Farrah Fowler, Maya Bialik, and Melissa Rauch, I knew if we added interesting characters that were in ongoing relationships with our principal characters, it would enlarge our principal characters. I just knew that. Beyond that, I had no idea what would happen. The specifics, no, I didn't have a clue. I just knew that, you know, you want to know somebody, see them in relationship. That's the way they're tested. Mm-hmm. You know, put them in an ongoing relationship that they can't run from. And you'll find out more about them. And we did.
And you really are listening to and adapting as a result of the response that you get from the live audience,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. The audience is a litmus test. It tells you when you're not as smart as you think you are. You know, I mean, it's amazing after all these years, the audience still surprises me when we shoot in front of an audience. Their response to the material is their response to the material. And it's sometimes I'll be angry with them. Why didn't you laugh at
right,
that?
Right.
I think that's very funny. What's wrong with you people?
Right.
But there it is, and we're putting on a live show, and it's not working in front of 200, 250 people, whatever that is. My assumption has always been that it won't work in a living room.
It's a sample size that's acceptable to you as
representative. If they're not laughing,
right.
and they're seeing actors. They're not looking at a television set. They're watching human beings in front of them perform.
Right.
And if they're not responding right there, where it's very electric, it's very visceral, then it's probably not going to be funny in your living room. So change it. Rewrite it, cut it, fix it, punch it up. And we, you know, take two, take three, the material changes.
And just to confirm, I know the answer to this, but there are no laugh tracks on a Chuck Lorre show?
No.
That is an option that I'm sure was available to you. Why did you decline to have that?
Well, if you're putting fake laughs on, assume it's not funny. Real people didn't laugh.
Right.
So if they're not laughing and it's not funny and you put it on TV, it's going to fail. I mean, it's a recipe for failure.
You can't fake them out.
The audience at home right. can feel the cognitive dissonance of, why am I hearing laughter? Because I'm not laughing.
Right.
I mean, the audience is much more savvy than to think you're going to put canned laughs on. I just think that's... It's just the worst kind of pandering to think you're going to fake somebody out and tell them it's funny by adding laughter. That's just, why? Why not try and make it funny?
Right.
Really funny,
right.
And then see what happens.
Do you ever, because you have to come up with so many ideas for so many different
no,
shows?
No, I don't. I have lots of really, really smart, funny
so
people.
So it's not a concern about running out of ideas?
No, because, you know, yes, if it was a one-man band, absolutely.
It would be.
After six episodes, these things would be done. So
with Big Bang, as you were saying earlier, I guess tonight is the final episode taping of Year 9.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have, I believe, historically done three-year renewals.
Mm-hmm.
How far do you see this continuing?
We are contracted to do one more year. Year 10 is already contracted for with CBS.
Mm-hmm.
So we know we're doing one more year. Beyond that, I don't know. That's a Leslie Moonves question.
But is it a desire of yours to have it continue beyond one more year?
You know, as long as the show's funny
yeah.
and everybody's having a good time, and that seems to be the case. I love the work we're doing.
Right.
I think the show, last couple of years, a young man named Steve Malero has stepped up to become the showrunner. And he's breathed life into it beyond my wildest dreams.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's the reason the show is flourishing in its eighth and ninth season is because of this guy and the incredible staff he's created around himself.
Right.
So why not?
Yeah.
You know, if it was drudgery and we were not making a good show
right.
and the show was kind of starting to flail around, then yeah, let's leave the stage before they start throwing tomatoes. But I don't feel like that's happening. I feel like the audience is still hanging in there with us.
Now, Mike and Molly is saying goodbye in a few weeks, May 16th, I believe. How do you feel about that? Do you feel, is that something that you are happy about? Is it something that you, it's hard to say goodbye to a show after several years? And I guess what led up to that and how do you feel about it?
This was sad. This felt premature. I was really disappointed that CBS was never terribly enthusiastic about it.
You think from the concept?
I don't know. I can't speak for them, but here we were in our sixth season. We'd been bounced around on the schedule for the last couple of seasons. We'd missed the fall season and been mid-season and, you know, scattershot around. So there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for the show. So it was hurtful because when you're in it, you're in it, you're in it, you believe in it. And I have to say it in a past tense, it was a great group of people.
Did you know, though, going into it that this one might be a little bit of a tougher sell than others, perhaps because you were dealing with two people who, at the time when it started, were not especially well-known, who perhaps did not conform to the typical look of a TV series lead? Do those things make you, even if it's not right, does that...
No, I actually thought that was the reason to do it. Yeah. I mean, Melissa and Billy... or brilliant comic actors, obviously. The world knows about Melissa. They're going to learn over the next few years about Billy as well. Jackie Gleason is smiling down on Billy. He's one of those guys who has those kind of chops.
Yeah.
When you're starting a romantic comedy with talents like that, what now? Screw the way it's usually done or what's come before. These people are brilliant, and this is a love story worth telling. And I'm proud of it. I'm very proud.
Sure. With Mom, I think it deals with more serious subject matter than some of the others, to the extent, just for people who are catching up, that you've even had to have a PSA announcement attached to one after a character's tragic death. I wondered, because in other interviews, I think it was the New Yorker profile, you've talked about for a few years you had your own struggles. What motivated you to tell a more serious story like this one, and does it feel different in terms of the work that you have to do to tell it than if you're telling one that's a more lighthearted show?
Storytelling on Mom is much more difficult.
Really?
Much more difficult. But it felt like the right time to try. I'd actually started in that area on Roseanne and Grace Under Fire, telling the pilot of Grace Under Fire was her fear that her 10-year-old son was a chip off the old block, and the old block was abusive, was physically abusive. She admits to having been in an abusive marriage. That was pretty heady stuff for 1993, but it worked. It was remarkably effective, and it was still funny, and it was heartbreaking at times. And we were able to do stories like that on Roseanne in the couple of years I was there. And then, for whatever reason, I moved away from that for a long time. And the idea of starting another show only made sense if the show was challenging and we were able to tell stories that were not normally done. And when you find the comedy in the darkness, it's really good. It's really rewarding, but oh my God, it's really hard to do. It's exhausting. But
because of
finding the balance. You don't want to be disrespectful.
Right.
Alcoholism and addiction ruins families. It wrecks lives. It's a disaster. And yet recovery is filled with laughter. It is. It's a remarkable thing. And so early on, I thought, if the premise of the series is hope, that there's hope that people can change, that regardless of their inability to do it well, they can grow. Right. And the clumsiness of growth is where the comedy is. I remember when we did the episode a couple of years ago where Allison and Anna's characters are coming to grips with their friend has breast cancer. All right, now, normally in a TV comedy, you wouldn't even say the word.
Mm-hmm.
It's just no.
Either word.
The word isn't said.
Network, yeah.
But the comedy came with their desire to want to be there for her and be supportive, but not knowing how. Their ineptitude at being supportive was where we found the comedy. Their desire to be there and be good friends and be loving and supportive of their friend, Mimi Kennedy's character, Marjorie, was genuine and real, and people experienced that. Not knowing how to do it was where the comedy came from, and it worked. It was really, that was a big step for the show. I think I learned a lot from that episode, that series of episodes, actually, that you can tackle these things and find a way in that still fulfills the contract with the audience, which is laughter. That's why, you know, there's no bombs going off, no airplanes right. coming over the horizon. Right. It's two people sitting having coffee and talking is pretty much what the show is about. So that storyline worked, and it kind of gave us the courage to go forward.
And this show has been particularly well received critically, Mom. But I know maybe, although the bar of ratings set by the others is huge, I mean, does it strike you as odd that critical acclaim and massive ratings, it seems like you can only hope for one or the other a lot of the time. Even awards, I think, how many people love and watch Big Bang every time, mm-hmm. and yet you look at the Emmys or whatever, and it's not necessarily reflected there.
No.
What do you make of that? And I'm not saying it won't be. It just, historically, it seems like there is this either-or mm-hmm. thing.
I've joked that if the ratings on Mom go down anymore, we'll win a Nobel Prize. but no, that's snide. I don't know. The only way to retain any sanity here is to not get caught up in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We get to make a TV show. We get to make the TV show we want to make.
Right.
I've been really blessed over the years because of the success of 2.5 Men and the Big Bang Theory to not have to deal with a lot of interference, a lot of, you know, second guessing. If I'm going to fail, I'm going to fail on my own instincts. Just shut up and be grateful for that is really the caption for that story. It's, you know, whether or not there's critical response, make the show you want to make. And then the rest of it's out of my control.
Right.
I mean, honestly, what am I going to do? I have control over the words on the page, and to some extent, I can influence the performances, and I have, you know, I'm in the editing bay. But after that, it's gone.
Right.
And let it go. And you know, I've been delighted by the critical response to Mom. Just really thrilling, because, you know, we've become sort of the redheaded stepchild, the four-camera sitcom, the live audience show is kind of considered old-fashioned.
For historical reference for our listeners, I mean, I think starting with I Love Lucy, mm-hmm. the multi-camera live audience show mm-hmm. became the thing.
Yeah.
And for a lot of years, it was.
Mm-hmm.
But since the turn of the century, apart from your shows, it seems like it's a pretty endangered species. And I wonder, in your estimation, why that would be. And why it's important to you to keep that format alive?
I don't think it's important to keep it alive.
You don't?
I really don't.
Okay.
That's not my job.
Mm-hmm.
My job is to make people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a comedy writer. My job is not to support a genre.
Mm-hmm.
That's presumptuous. You know, if the audience has turned away from it, the only plausible reason I can think of is they've been disappointed too many times. You know, the cognitive dissonance of hearing laughter and not laughing. The only real response that is worthwhile is laughter. And if you're laughing, you actually shouldn't even hear the audience laughing, because you're laughing.
Right.
If you're not laughing, there's that dissonance, and then I think you push away from it. I think that's just natural. I mean, if you're watching a scary movie and you're not scared, something's wrong, right? You know?
Right.
I mean, if the girl is screaming and hiding because the bad guy's coming in and you're just kind of like, you're looking at your watch, it's not working. So if the genre might be in trouble, it's because it hasn't been working. But when you stop and think about it, it was working for Seinfeld.
Right.
It was working for Raymond. It worked for Cheers.
Right.
It worked for Roseanne. It worked for even, you know, you go back to Taxi and some magnificent comedies that were done in front of an audience. It's a, and you can go way back, but, you know, it's theater.
But you don't feel beholden to it in the sense that it's now very much out there that your next project is about this pot dispensary in Colorado, and that you guys
well,
are...
Well, you know, if this thing passes in November, we might move it to California.
To California, right. But, I mean, the idea now, apparently, from what's been reported, and I think you don't dispute this, it's now being shopped around to a wide variety of places, not just CBS or wherever. So I wonder if a streaming service like Netflix or somebody came and said, we'd love to have you do it on our platform, where for the first time maybe ever, I think for you, you are not beholden to a certain number of episodes per season. You can say or show whatever you want. Does that prospect, and again, you maybe not be multi-camera,
mm-hmm.
do those possibilities appeal to you? Are you curious?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Listen, I would love to try and work in another way. You know, you write a script and then shoot it. from what I understand, there's a great deal of work in editing because right. you have so much footage. Editing a four-camera show is pretty simple. It's a couple of days and you're done. Mm-hmm. It's a whole other kind of storytelling when you're doing a film show where you're you know, using the camera in a very different way. So yeah, I'm curious. I'd like to be given the opportunity at some point to fail at that, or take my best shot. It's still storytelling,
right?
And I'm still helplessly enamored with laughter, and laughter still has to be part of the equation. Otherwise, I'm a very simple man. It's not comedy if you're not laughing.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're amused, that's fine, but right. that's not the point.
Right.
The point is to provoke laughter. Whether you use four cameras or one, that's what you're trying for.
Right.
Yeah, short answer to your question is I'd love to do a show film style.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened yet.
Not yet, but maybe that's next.
Who knows?
Well, the final question is this. Between the original runs of your shows and then often overlappingly even the syndication, which I think seems like it maybe feeds the continued original runs, right? I mean, it's happened yeah. with so many of your yeah. shows. Your work has reached a lot of people. And I just wonder for you, as you go out amongst the masses and, you know, talk about your...
go out amongst yeah. the masses. Because they're not here in Burbank. Well, the masses aren't here in Burbank.
But, I mean, what is the most meaningful feedback that you get from these many, many people who watch what you do every week? What means the most to you to hear from them?
Well, you know, I came up with the dream of being a musician, and I was always in love with great songs. I thought great songs are magical things. The greater the song, the longer the lifespan. They seem to be timeless, you know. What Beatles song is dated? I mean, truly, they're as great now as they were when they were written. And the idea that you can make a TV show that might have some longevity, that's a dream come true for me. I always... like the idea that I'd rather make handkerchiefs than tissues. Handkerchiefs can be used
right,
again.
Right.
But in answer to your question about talking to people, about watching the shows and mm-hmm. their feedback, the shows become meaningful to people when they're watching them over a period of time. That's how I felt growing up. Shows were meaningful to me. When they got taken off the air, I disavowed television after the Smothers Brothers and Star Trek were canceled. I think the same year. It might have been like 69 or something like that. It was a bad year. You kidding me? You're taking off Star Trek and the Smothers Brothers in the same year?
Right.
You know, that was one was immensely funny and sophisticated, right. and Star Trek was, you know, for a science fiction fan, it was a dream come true. So I went, all right, I'm done with television, right?
That's it.
But then you fall in love with the show. I certainly do. And it becomes part of your week. You look forward to it. I do.
True.
You know, oh boy, it's Thursday night. Cheers is on. Seinfeld's on. All the great NBC comedies over the years. And so to be able to say that we may have accomplished that with some of these things is immensely gratifying. You know, and then you feel an obligation. You don't want to let them down. I don't want show 211 to suck. I want it to be just as good as show 9.
That might be the first one somebody sees.
Yeah, it might be, because the way these things run yeah. in syndication, or you sit in a plane on JetBlue and you plug in your headphones and there's a Big Bang episode, I want it to be a great one, because mm-hmm. that might be your only experience of the show. Again, I had never dreamed that I'd be in this position, looking back, that, you know, have TV shows that actually matter to people. And, you know, the real question is how to proceed in a way that maybe I can get home earlier.
Well, I'm happy you get your break now
getting
after
break
tonight.
Now.
Yeah, enjoy. Yeah. And thank you so much for this.
Thanks.
Really appreciate
this was a lot of fun.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.